down the hall. But right now she was listening to Louis. Louis shied away from bright electric lights, a soul of the 19th century, he confessed, preferring these old-fashioned candles, and especially here in this high-glass apartment with the brightness of Midtown all around them, providing all the night-time illumination that they might ever need. Indeed, the sky was never black above the great, sharp, gleaming silver point of the Art Deco Chrysler building, and the countless towers crowding it, in this safe weald of myriad lighted windows that seemed to hold them here more securely in space than the steel girders of this skyscraper, whose elevators had brought them to this carpeted haven on the 63rd floor. Guards in the next-door apartment, guards in the marble lobby downstairs, guards out on the narrow pavements of 57th Street, guards in the apartment above and in the apartment below. And Thorn here, the red-haired blood-drinker, the Viking blood-drinker in a grey wool coat, standing like a sentinel beside the entrance to the hallway, his arms folded, staring out at the night. If he heard what they were saying to one another, he gave no sign of it. He'd been motionless since he'd arrived. They sat across from one another, Louis and Rose, at a small round glass table with modern black enamelled Queen Anne chairs. He wore a long sweater of black wool that curled at the neck. His hair was as black as the sweater, but it was glossy, and his eyes were shining like the emerald ring he wore on his hand. His face was so bright it made her think of something D.H. Lawrence had written, a line from Sons and Lovers about a man's face in his youth having been the flower of his body. For the first time, Rose sensed she knew now what Lawrence had meant. Louis was saying, in his patient, tender voice, "You think you know, but you can't know. Who wouldn't be blinded by the offer of eternal life?" He'd been there for hours, patiently answering Rose's questions, explaining things about his own point of view. "We don't have eternal life firmly within our grasp. We have to work at it to remain immortal. All around us we see other blood drinkers perish, because they don't have the spiritual stamina for this, because they never transcend the first few years of shocks and revelations, or because they're killed by others, ripped right out of life by violence. We're only immortal in the sense that we don't age, that illness can't take us down, and that we have the potential to live forever. But most of us live very short lives indeed." She nodded. "What you're trying to tell me is that it's a completely final decision," she said. "But I don't know if you can possibly understand how total my obsession with it has become." He sighed. There was a sadness about him even in his brightest moments, when he'd been talking of Lestat and Lestat's ebullience and refusal to accept defeat. He'd smiled then, and it had been rare sunshine, that smile. But his charm was obviously wrapped up in melancholy and unshakable gloom. Victor came forward and for the first time in an hour took a chair between them. Faint scent of that acqua de Gio that was now all over her pillow and her sheets, and all over her dreams. "What Louis is saying," he said to Rose, "is that once we do pass that barrier, we'll know things that we'll never be able to change or forget. Sure, we are obsessed now. We want it. How can we not want it? From our point of view, it's not discussable. But he's trying to warn us. Once we cross, we'll be obsessed by something totally different. And that obsessive awareness that we're not alive anymore, not human, that's never going to be undone. That's never going to go away. You follow me? What we're obsessed with now, that may go away." "I understand," said Rose. "Believe me, I do." Louis shook his head. He drew up his shoulders and then slowly relaxed again, laying his right hand idly on the table. He was looking at the table, but he was looking at his thoughts. "When Lestat comes, it will be his decision, of course." "I'm not so sure why that should be," said Victor. "I'm not sure at all why I can't make the decision with the agreement of Farid or Seth. Farid brought me into this world, really, not Lestat." "Then nobody's going to make the decision except Uncle Lestat," said Rose. "That's clear enough. No one is willing to make it. And frankly, well, this evening we've had a chance to speak our hearts about this, and I'm grateful. We've had a chance to say out loud what we want." Victor looked at Louis. "You say wait. You say, take your time. But what if we die while we're waiting? What then? What would you think? Would you regret our having waited? I don't know the point any more of waiting. You'll die to become this, said Louis. You can't grasp it. You die. You can't become what we are unless you die. I suppose finally I'm saying this. You think you are making what the world calls an informed decision, but you're not. You can't. You can't know what this is like, to be both alive and dead. Victor didn't answer. He didn't even seem overly concerned. He was so excited that they were here, so excited that they'd come this far. He was full of anticipation. Rose looked away and then back at the pensive face of Louis, at his dark green eyes and the set of his mouth. A handsome man of 24, maybe, when he'd been brought over, and what a scathing portrait he'd given the world of Uncle Lestat, his maker, Lestat. But that didn't matter now, did it? No, not at all. She thought of the others whom she'd glimpsed last night, coming into the rooftop ballroom of the huge house called Trinity Gate. She had become used to the preternatural glow of Farid, even of the powerful Seth, who always stood away from the bright electric lamps when he'd come to her, who spoke from the shadows in a low, secretive voice, as if he were afraid of its volume, its vibrato. But nothing had prepared her for seeing them all in that huge ballroom at the top of the long flight of marble stairs. Farid had been uneasy with her being brought there. She knew it, could feel it. It was Seth who'd made the decision for her and for Victor. Seth, who had said, "Why keep them locked away?" As far as Rose could see, Seth's mind was made up. Gilded tables and chairs had been scattered on the periphery all along both sides of the dance floor, against walls of French doors panelled in mirrored glass. Drowsy green palms and blue and pink and red flowers in bronze pots were placed every few feet in tasteful groupings. And at the end stood the grand piano and the cluster of musicians and singers, blood-drinkers all, who'd enchanted her with their physical beauty, as well as the sounds they made, violinists, harpists, singers making a symphony of sorts that filled the immense glass-ceilinged room. There had been bright, unnatural faces everywhere under the three crystal chandeliers in the dreamy gloom. The names had passed her in a steady, numbing current as she was introduced. Pandora, Arjun, Gregory, Zenobia, Davis, Avicus, Everard. She couldn't remember them all, couldn't recall at will all the remarkable visages, the particularities that had enthralled her as she was brought from table to table across the dark, polished floor. And then the striking otherworldly musicians, the tall, bald-headed and smiling Notker, who bowed to her, and his violinists from the mountains, and the young boys and women who'd been singing with such brilliant and throbbing soprano voices, and then Antoine, who looked like the impersonation of Paganini with his violin, and Cybele in long black chiffon, her neck positively wrapped in diamonds, rising from the piano bench to take her hand. Out of the pages she'd read, out of the fictions that had permeated her dreams, they'd come alive around her, along with a multitude of strangers, and she'd found herself seeking desperately to engrave every moment on her quivering heart. Victor had been so very much more prepared for it, a human child brought up amongst blood-drinkers, easily clasping hands and nodding and answering questions, though he had stayed right at Rose's side. He'd picked the long white silk dress for her out of her closet, and worn a black velvet jacket with a boiled shirt for the occasion, beaming down at her again and again as if he were proud to have her hand on his arm. She had felt certain the blood-drinkers were all concealing their curiosity and amazement at seeing them, which was so funny because she was so very shocked at seeing all of them. Marius had embraced her, the only one to do it, and whispered poetry to her. "Oh, she doth teach the torches to burn bright. It seems she hangs upon the cheek of night like a rich jewel." He'd kissed Victor also. "Such a gift you are for your father," he had said, and Victor had smiled. She had known Victor was on the edge of tears that Lestat had not come yet, but Lestat was on his way, that was now certain. He'd gone south on an errand to the Amazon that could not wait, but he was coming, most definitely coming. Seth assured them of this himself. He claimed to have heard it from an unimpeachable source, Lestat's own mother. and Rose had been on the edge of breaking down at that news, but all this had made the suspense not only endurable but engulfing. Surely Seth wouldn't have revealed the full depth of their world to her if Uncle Lestan, if Lestat was not to give both of them the dark gift. The dark gift. She liked to whisper those words. There had come a moment last night when it seemed the entire company was on the dance floor, and some of the blood drinkers were singing softly with the musicians, and the entire ballroom was wrapped in a cloud of golden light. She had been dancing with Victor, and he had bent and kissed her lips. "I love you, Rose," he had said, and she dug deep down into her soul at that moment, and asked herself, could they turn away from this, actually turn away from it and go to some other place, some safe place where their natural love for each other would be enough to dim the memories of this? She and Victor had known, surely, the most tantalizing intimacy, the sweetest affection, the purest love-making she had ever imagined. It had erased for her all the ugliness and horror of what had happened with Gardner, all the shame and the crushing disappointment. By day, when blood drinkers slept and their mysteries were gone along with them, she'd held Victor against her heart and he'd held her, and that had been its own miracle, its own sacrament, its own gift. She shuddered. She realized now that Louis was looking at her, and so was Victor. Louis very likely had been reading her thoughts. Had he seen those images of her with Victor together? She blushed. "I think Seth has made the decision," said Louis, speaking to her very thoughts. "Otherwise he would never have brought you to Trinity Gate last night. No, he's only waiting for Lestat to ratify it. He's made up his mind." Rose smiled, but felt the sting of tears in her eyes. "He'll come tonight. I know he will," said Louis. "Farid places a high value on human life, human experience," said Victor. "Maybe my father does too. I think that Seth cares nothing for human experience much at all." Rose knew that Victor was right. She remembered too vividly the first time she'd ever laid eyes on Seth. It had been in the small hours, and she'd been in pain. Needles, tape, monitors all around her. Victor wasn't coming back until morning, and Dr. Gilman could not be found. Seth had come to her, a dark-eyed man in the ubiquitous white scrubs of the hospital, who stood at a remove from her bed, talking to her in a low voice. He'd told her the pain would vanish if she would listen to him, just follow his words, and sure enough, as he talked to her about the pain, as he asked her to describe it in colours and to picture it and to say what and where she felt it, the pain had melted away. She cried. She'd told him about Uncle Lestan and how he'd wanted her to be a happy, healthy young woman and how she'd ruined it again and again. Maybe she'd never been good enough, she'd said, for life. A soft, cold laugh had come from Seth. He'd explained with great authority that she had ruined nothing, that life was in charge of life, that pain was everywhere, that it was as much a part of the process of life as birth and death. "But the joy you've known, the love you've known, that is what matters. And we, the conscious ones, the ones who can grieve, only we can know joy." It had been a strange meeting. And she hadn't seen him again until she was much better, and she'd been certain then that he was no more human than Uncle Lestan was human. And she'd known by then, too, that Farid wasn't human, and Dr. Gilman wasn't human either, and that Victor knew all this with a far greater understanding than she could possibly have. She'd been wrestling with it, pacing the floor of her room in the desert hospital, interrogating her own senses, her own sense of normality. And Seth had appeared and said, "Don't let us drive you mad." He'd moved out of the shadows and taken her hands in his. "I am just what you think and what you fear," he'd told her. "Why shouldn't you know? Why shouldn't you understand?" The effect of those nighttime conversations had been incalculable, and the first time that she and Victor had been intimate, she'd said in his ear, "Don't be afraid for me. I do know what they are. I know all about it. I understand." "Thank heaven," Victor had replied. They had snuggled together spoon-fashion, and he had kissed her hair. "Because I can't lie about it any more. I can keep secrets, but I can't tell lies." She looked at him now, looked at the manner in which he sat there in the chair, looking at the far glass wall and the vibrant cityscape beyond it, and she felt such love for him, such love and trust. She looked at Louis, Louis who was watching her again as if reading her thoughts. "You've been more than kind," she said, "but if we're cast out of all this, if that's what ultimately happens, I don't know what future there can be for us." She looked at Victor. His expression told her nothing except that he loved her, and that he had a patience with this that she didn't have. She tried to imagine it, them together, married, with children, their very own rosy-cheeked children, little children, drifting through the world on the magic carpet of the wealth bequeathed to them by beings of a secret and unknown realm. She couldn't imagine it. Couldn't. But surely somehow it would never come to that. This would not all be consigned to miraculous memory meant to fade with every passing year. She looked at Louis, and he gave her one of those rare, bright smiles. He seemed warm and human suddenly, and too grand to be mortal all at the same time. "It really is a gift, isn't it?" asked Rose. A shadow fell over his expression, but then he smiled again and he took her hand.
"If Lestat can make it right, well then it will be made right," he said, "for both of you. But there are other things happening just now. Other things, and no one is going to bring you into our world until those challenges have been met."
"I know," she said. "I know." She wanted to say more, that it was so kind of Louis to stay with them, to wait with them, when obviously it must have been difficult to leave the ever-growing crowds at Trinity Gate. But she'd said this over and over, and she knew that her thanks to anyone and everyone were becoming a kind of burden, and she left it where it was. She got up and went to the great wall of glass to look out at the city, to let her eyes move through this glamorous wild wood in which life itself was teeming everywhere around her, as surely as it did in faraway streets below. And only yards away it seemed there were darkened windows revealing smoky and ghostly offices, and crowded bedrooms and living rooms, and rooftops lying before her with gleaming blue swimming pools, and some with green gardens, perfect gardens, like toy gardens, with toy-like trees she felt she could reach out and pick up with her fingers, and all this stretching on towards the great distant shadow of Central Park. "I want to remember these nights always," she thought. "I want to fix them forever in my memory. I want to lose nothing. When it's done, when it's decided and it's over, I will write a memoir seeking to capture everything forever. When it's happening, it is too beautiful, too overwhelming, and you can feel it's being lost with every breath you take." Quite suddenly, a deep, dark mass appeared above her, something like a cloud, forming and descending right before her eyes. In a split second it thickened and rose up in front of her, virtually blinding her as she fell back away from the transparent wall. A great boom sounded, a great terrible crashing roar and a clatter, and she felt herself falling, and all around her came down a rain of broken, glittering glass. Her head hit the hardwood floor. There were deafening noises, furniture being smashed, pictures and mirrors falling, and the loud, cold wind was rushing through the room. Doors slammed, more glass was breaking. She rolled over on her side, her hair whipped against her face by the wind, her hands grasping for something, anything firm, to steady her, when she saw the treacherous glass splinters all around her, and she began to scream. She saw Thorn fly at a brown-haired figure clothed all in black, who stood before the overturned and broken table, but the figure slammed Thorn away with such force he appeared to fly across the length of the room. Louis lay sprawled on the floor in a pool of blood. Victor came rushing towards Rose. The brown-haired figure snatched up Victor in one arm, though Victor was fighting against him with all his strength, and as Thorn rushed at the figure again, he grabbed Thorn's hair with one hand and hurled him away once more. For a moment this tall creature, who held Victor effortlessly in the grip of his left arm, looked down at Rose and came towards her. But Louis rose up behind him like a great shadow, and the stranger veered, spinning backwards and smashing Louis with his right fist. Again and again Rose screamed. The figure rose off the floor, wrapping both arms around Victor, and he went out through the great jagged hole in the glass wall. It went out and upwards and vanished into the sky. And she knew where that brown-haired one had taken Victor. She knew. Up and up, faster than the wind and towards the stars. powerful as Uncle Lestan, unstoppable as Uncle Lestan, who'd rescued her from that little island in the Mediterranean so very long ago. Victor was gone. Rose couldn't stop screaming. She crawled on her knees through the broken glass. Thorn lay to the far right, his face and head covered in blood. Louis crawled towards Rose. Suddenly Louis was on his feet. He lifted her in his arms and carried her out of the room, out of the cold, lashing wind. Thorn was staggering right behind him, hitting the walls on both sides like a drunken man, blood pouring down into his eyes. Louis rushed with her down the long hallway. She clung to him, crying, as he carried her into the bedroom that was hers in this place, and put her down gently, gently as if she'd break on the white bed. Thorn clung to the sides of the doorway as if he might fall. There were voices in the hallway, feet pounding, shouts.
"Tell them all to get out," said Louis. "Call the house. We're going there now."
She tried to stop, crying. She was choking. She couldn't breathe.
"But who was it? Who took him? Who did it?" she sobbed.
Again she began to scream.
"I don't know," Louis said.
Louis wrapped her up in the white cover of the bed, cradling her, rocking her, kissing her until she went quiet. Then he carried her out of the apartment and held her tight against him in the elevator as they went down to the underground garage. Finally, when they were in the car moving uptown sluggishly on Madison Avenue, with Thorn in the front seat beside the driver, she'd been able to stop crying altogether as she leaned against Louis's chest.
"But why did he take Victor? Why? Where has he taken him?"
She couldn't stop asking. Couldn't stop. She could hear Thorn in a low voice talking to Louis. She felt Louis's right hand around her forehead, turning her face towards him, and his left hand lightly touching her waist. He bent his head and pressed his ear against her neck. His skin was silky, just like Uncle Lestan's skin had always been, cold, but like silk.
"Rose, Lestat's come. He's at the house. He's waiting for you. You're safe. You're all right."
She stopped sobbing only when she saw him. He stood in the front hallway with his arms out. Her Uncle Lestan, her beloved Uncle Lestan, an angel to her, timeless, unchanged, forever beautiful.
"My Rose," he whispered, "my darling Rose."
"They took Victor, Uncle Lestan," she sobbed. "Someone took him."
The tears ran down her face as she looked up at him.
"Uncle Lestan, he's gone."
"I know, my darling. And we will get him back. Now come to me," he said, his powerful arms closing around her. "You are my daughter."
21. Rosamandi's The Devil's Gambit. He was in a rage, but then he'd been in a rage since he'd struck down Maharat, since he'd doubled over with the machete in his hands, confronted with what he'd done, and the ghastly realization that he could not possibly undo it. And now that he had Victor in his hands, which the voice had so furiously urged him to achieve, he was more than ever boiling with rage against the voice, against himself, against the wide world in which he'd survived for so long, and in which he now found himself trapped, and certain of nothing except that he had not wanted this. He, personally, had never wanted it. He stood on the broad wooden deck of this house in Montauk, on the shore of Long Island, staring out over the cold, glassy Atlantic. What in the name of hell was he to do now? How could he possibly achieve what the voice insisted he must achieve? The word had gone out of the airwaves immediately that Victor had been kidnapped. Benji Mahmoud had been cagey and brilliant. An ancient immortal had committed a dastardly deed. Yes, the vile little vampiric Edward R. Murrow had used that term, in kidnapping one cherished by all the elders of the tribe, and he called to the children of the night throughout the world to listen for the malignant heart and mind of this ancient one, to discover this one's evil designs, and to call the numbers at Trinity Gate in New York as soon as the monster and his helpless victim were discovered. Benedict sat in the spacious, barren, all too modern living room of this glorified peasant's hut on this expensive coast only hours by car from New York, staring at the screen of the laptop as he listened to Benji's reports.
"The Stade de Liancourt has arrived. There are now innumerable elders amongst us. But again, I caution you, children of the night, lay low where you are. Do not seek to come here. Let the elders meet. give the elders a chance to stop the destruction, and search, search for this evil outlaw among us who has kidnapped one of our own from us. Search, but take care. An ancient one can conceal his thoughts, but he cannot conceal the powerful beating of his heart, nor can he entirely conceal a low humming sound emanating from his very person. Call us with all reports, and please, I beg the rest of you, stay off the phone lines until the kidnapped victim is found, or until you have further reports from me.
Benedict shut down the volume. He got up from the low-slung synthetic couch that smelled vaguely of petrol chemicals.
"But that's just it," said Benedict. "There are no young blood drinkers around here. None. They were all driven out of the New York hunting ground a long time ago. We've scanned this entire area. There's nobody out here but us. And even if they do find us, what does it matter, as long as I'm standing right beside him when you make your case to Farid?"
It struck Rochamandes again, as it had in the jungles of the Amazon, that Benedict had been displaying an amazing gift for battle and intrigue, ever since this nasty business had started in earnest. Who would have expected the mild-mannered and genuinely loving Benedict to drive his machete into Maharit's skull at the moment when Roche was frozen with panic? Who would have expected him to so handily carry the violent but helpless young Victor to the bedroom upstairs and lock him securely in the large windowless bathroom, remarking so coolly, "Best place for a mortal, obviously, with all that plumbing"? Who would have expected Benedict to have been so handy, with hardware store chains and padlocks, to secure that bathroom prison with such simple and clever gestures, piling a store of wooden nails and a hammer nearby, if further security measures were needed? And who but Benedict would have outfitted the bathroom beforehand with every conceivable amenity, scented candles, toilet articles, even popular magazines, a microwave oven for the cooking of the stacks of canned foods he'd bought, and heaps of plastic forks and knives and spoons, as well as paper bowls and dishes. He'd even included a little refrigerator in the bath full of carbonated sodas and a bottle of the finest Russian vodka, and had thrown in several soft new blankets for the boy and a pillow so he could sleep comfortably on the tiled floor when exhaustion eventually got the best of him.
"We don't want him to panic," Benedict had said. "We want him to remain calm and cooperative so this thing can be finished."
By day the boards and nails would make his escape impossible, and for now, when he became panicky, he could press the intercom to speak to his captors. That he had not done yet. Perhaps he was simply too angry to utter coherent words. That would not have been surprising. One thing was certain. Someone very powerful had taught this human how to completely lock off his mind from all telepathic intrusion. He was as skilled at that as any scholarly member of the Talamasca. And as far as Roche knew, no mortal or immortal could open a telepathic line to others without opening himself to intrusion. So that meant the boy wasn't frantically attempting to send messages to others. And maybe he didn't know how. The vampires who brought him up might have taught him many things, but not how to be a human psychic. Rochamandes didn't much believe in human telepathy anyway, but he had to stop thinking about this. He had to stop thinking about all the different ways this spectacular gambit might fail, and it strongly occurred to him that he ought to call Trinity Gate now and return the boy and throw himself on the mercy of the gathering blood drinkers.
"Are you insane?" said the voice to him. "Are you simply out of your mind? You do that and they'll destroy you. What in the world would prompt them to have the slightest mercy? Since when do blood drinkers have honour?"
"Well, they had better have some, or this plan simply isn't going to work," said Roche.
Benedict knew Roche was talking aloud to the voice, but he remained attentive, desperate to know what was happening.
"I'll tell you this much on my honour," said Roche,
aloud, for the benefit of Benedict as well as the voice.
"The very first thing I will do when I have the power is destroy that little Bedouin. I'm going to take that noisy, impudent little monster in my hands and squeeze the life and the blood and the brains out of him. I'm going to drain him dry and tear his remains into shreds. And I'll do that in the presence of his blessed Cybele and his blessed Armand and his blessed maker Marius."
"And just how," asked Benedict gently, "are you going to seize and maintain power?"
"It's pointless bothering with that question," said the voice.
I've explained myself to your starry-eyed acolyte over and over. When you have me inside you, no one can harm you. You will be as untouchable as Macare is now.
Macare. Without Benedict, would Roche have ever dared to attempt moving her? Again, Benedict had taken the lead. The night after the killing of Maharit, as Roche called his mortal agents to arrange for a domicile in North America, Benedict had gone off into the jungle to find Macare a tender young female victim from one of the naked tribes. Benedict had put this frightened and utterly malleable woman into Macari's arms, the whole while whispering softly to Macare that she should drink, that she needed the strength, that they had a journey to take, and he'd sat there patiently waiting till the silent monster had slowly wakened to the smell of the blood, slowly lifted her left hand as though it were an unbearable weight, and laid it on the breast of the prone victim. With lightning speed she'd closed her teeth on the sweet little girl's neck, drinking slowly until the heart was stopped and could pump no more blood into her. Even after that she drank, her powerful heart drawing the blood until the victim was pale and shriveling. Then she'd sat back, eyes empty as always, her pink tongue licking her pretty lips slowly and efficiently. There wasn't the tiniest spark of reason in her. And it was Benedict who suggested that they wrap her, that they find the finest coverings or garments that they could, and that they wrap her as if she were a mummy in those garments, and then they might carry her north safely to accomplish their purpose. "Remember, Marius wrapped the king and queen," he'd said, "before he moved them from Egypt." Yes, well, if Marius had been telling the truth in that old story. It had worked. Her fine green robe of interwoven silk and cotton, with its trimming of gold and jewels, had been spotless, no need to change it. Only wrap her gently in fresh-washed sheets and blankets, slowly, slowly, binding her gently, whispering to her the whole while. It seemed she'd welcomed the soft silk scarf blindfold. Or she hadn't cared. She hadn't cared any more about anything. She was way past caring, way past sensing that anything around her was amiss. Oh, that we become such monsters! It was unthinkable. It made Roche shudder. Only once had there been a bad moment, an alarming moment. Benedict, after binding her head securely in silk, had backed off suddenly, almost stumbling in his haste to get away from her. He stood staring at her. "What is it?" Roche had demanded. The panic was contagious. "Tell me!"
"I saw something," Benedict whispered. "I saw something I think that she has seen."
"You're imagining it," said Roche. "She sees nothing. Go on, finish."
What had that been? That thing that Benedict had seen? Roche didn't want to know, didn't dare to want to know, but he couldn't stop wondering. When they'd had her securely bound like a dead one in a shroud, it had been possible then to leave that horrid place, that awful place that had been Maharit's hearth and sanctum. Roche had had enough of looking through the storerooms, of looking at books and parchments and ancient keepsakes, enough, the desks, the computers, all of it. It was tainted with death. He would have taken the jewels, perhaps, and the gold, but he didn't need these things, and he couldn't bear to touch them. It was sacrilege, somehow, stealing the personal treasures of the dead. He'd been unable to reason himself out of it. When they were at the edge of the garden enclosure, he turned back, pulled the pin from the grenade he'd brought with him, and hurled it into the lighted doorway. The explosion was immediate. The flames raged through the buildings. Then they had brought the silent burden to these shores, to a planned location obtained through the mortal attorneys with the least amount of delay, and put her to rest in a cool, darkened cellar with its small windows soon boarded up by the ever-resourceful Benedict. Only the heartbeat of that bundled body gave evidence of life. Benedict stood beside him at the railing of the deck. The wind off the Atlantic was deliciously cold, not as fierce as the winds of the northern seas, but bracing, clean and good.
"Well, I understand. You'll be untouchable, but how can you maintain power over them enough, say, to kill Benji Mahmoud before their very eyes?"
"What are they going to do about it?" asked Roche. "And suppose I threaten them that I lie in the sun at dawn, as does happen to be my custom, by the way, and can be no more, unless I and they want the younger ones to be devoured by fire when my body, the source body, suffers that insult.
"'Would I die?' asked Benedict. "'If you did that? "'I mean, once you have the sacred core.' "'Yes, but I'd never do it,' Roche whispered. "'Don't you see?' "'Then what good is the threat, if they know you love me?'
"'But they don't know,' said the voice. "'That's the thing. They don't know. They know almost nothing about you.'
The voice was fuming again. "'And you can strengthen your friend with your blood. Strengthen him to where he suffers from such a burning, but not fatally.' Why have you not given him more of your blood over the centuries? And then, of course, your blood will be the source blood, and the strongest that there is, and you will feel the engines of power grinding in you with a new efficiency and fury.
Leave this in my hands, said Roche to Benedict. And no, you might not at all die were I to make good on my threat. Burn, yes, but die, no, and I will give you my blood. He felt like a fool, suddenly obeying the voice's orders.
"'But you could never make another blood-drinker,' said Benedict, "'because if you did, you wouldn't be able to make the threat—'
"'Stop talking,' said Roche. "'I have no choice now, do I, but to follow this through. "'I must get Farid to put the sacred core into me. "'Never mind all the rest. "'Just remember the instructions I've given you. "'Be ready at any moment for my phone call.'
"'I am,' said Benedict.
And don't, whatever you do, don't call me. Keep the phone ready. And when I call and instruct you to begin torturing the boy, that is if I have to do that, then you must do it, and they must be able to hear his screams through the phone.
Very well, said Benedict disgustedly. But you do realize I've never tortured a human being before.
Oh, come on, it won't be that difficult. Look at what you've done already. You've taken to this, you know you have... You'll figure a way to make him scream. Look, it's simple. Break his fingers one by one. There are 10 of them.
Benedict sighed.
They will not harm me as long as the boy is in our hands, don't you see? And when I return here with Farid, we'll deal with the goddess in the cellar, you understand?
All right, said Benedict, with the same tone of bitter resignation.
And then I will be the one, and you will be my beloved. As you have always been.
Very well.
Truly, with his whole soul, he wished he had not killed Maharit and Cayman. With his whole heart, he wished there were some escape now from this. Blood guilt. That had been the name for what he was feeling now. Thousands of years ago, as a boy on Crete, he'd known what blood guilt was when you killed those who were your own, and Maharit and Cayman had not been enemies.
"'Oh, junk poetry! Junk philosophy!' sang the voice. "'She was going to plunge with her sister into the volcano. I told you. You did what you had to do, as moderns so simply put it. Forget the ways of ancient cultures. You are a blood-drinker of immense physical and spiritual power. I will tell you what is sin and what is guilt. Now go to them and make your demand, and leave your acolyte here to slice off the head of that boy upstairs if they do not give in to you.'
When they find out.
They know, said the voice. Turn up your computer volume. Benjamin Mahmoud is telling them everything.
And it was true. He sat down on the couch beside the laptop with its glowing screen. The website of Benji Mahmoud now showed, of all things, Benji's very own likeness, not in a still photograph, but in a video. There he was with his black fedora and his sharp, penetrating black eyes. His round face fiercely animated with the tale he told.
Lestat is with us. Lestat has been to the jungles of the Amazon seeking the divine twins, the keepers of the sacred core, and Lestat has come back to tell the tale. The great Maharit has been murdered. Her companion Cayman has been murdered. Their remains were left in a shameful, shallow grave, their house desecrated. And the silent one, the passive one, the brave and enduring one, Makare, is missing. Who has done these things we know not, but we do know this. We stand united against this wicked one.
Roche sighed and sat back on the white couch.
What are you waiting for? Asked Benedict. Their house desecrated.
Let them come together, said the voice. Let them weigh their losses.
Let them weigh what they stand to lose. Let them learn obedience. The hour of midnight has not yet struck, and by that time they will have come to realize their helplessness.
Roche didn't bother to answer. Benedict started to question him again. Go see to the prisoners, he said to Benedict, and went back out to look over the sea and seriously consider drowning himself, though he knew it wasn't possible, and he had no choice now but to play this game to the finish. 22. Gregory. Trinity Gate. Inheriting the Wind. Gregory had to admire this enigmatic Lestat. Never mind that Gregory was in love with him. Who could not admire a creature with such perfect poise, such perfect pitch, for what to say to each and every blood-drinker who approached him? A creature who could lapse into the greatest tenderness with his mortal ward Rose in his arms, and then turn with such fury on Seth, the powerful Seth demanding to know how and why he'd exposed these mortal children to such disasters. And then how easily he'd wept when greeting Louis and Armand, and his lost, fledgling Antoine, whom he'd long ago consigned to history, alive here and thriving with Benji and Cybele. How considerately he'd held Antoine's hand, as the other stammered and trembled and tried to express his love, and how patiently he'd kissed Antoine, and assured him that they would have many nights together, all of them, and they would come to know each other and love each other as never before. "We must all come to the table and talk of what's happening," Lestat had said, so easily assuming command. "Armand, I say let's do this in the attic ballroom. I'll be there as soon as I've taken Rose safely down to the cellar and talked with her. And Benji, you must be there. You must shut down broadcasting long enough to be there. Do you understand? No one can absent himself or herself. The crisis is too great. Maharit, Cayman, murdered, their house burned, Mekari gone. The voice is inheriting the wind, and we have to hold this tent together against it." Gregory was tempted to applaud. It was fireworks in the front hallway. Armand had agreed at once as though it were the most natural thing in the world to do what Lestat wanted. But wasn't it what they all wanted? And what a dashing and beautiful figure Lestat was, the James Bond of the vampires indeed. How had he managed, under such pressure, to show up at Trinity Gate in a fresh and show-stopping ensemble of Ralph Lauren wool plaids and pastel linen and silk, with brown and white wing-tip shoes and his full shining mane of blonde hair, just possibly the most fabled head of hair in the vampire world, tied at the back of his neck in black silk beneath a diamond brooch that might have ransomed a king, but likely not his son Victor? The plaid coat was a long hacking jacket, exquisitely like a frock coat of an earlier time when fashion had been more daring and consciously romantic, and it fairly well concealed some sort of weapon, a large weapon that he carried, scent of wood and steel, without losing its beautiful shape and cut. Oh, this was the blood drinker of now, the vampire of now for certain. Who else could better grasp that now was the golden time for all the undead, transcending all ages past, and who else better to take the helm at this perfect moment? So what if it had taken this crisis to bring him to himself? Beside Gregory, Zenobia, Avicus, and Flavius evinced the same complete admiration and fascination, Flavius laughing softly under his breath. "He is all that anyone ever said he was," he whispered to Gregory. And Gregory felt that giddy, ridiculous feeling so many mortals have described over the millennia, of utter devotion to another, so well expressed in the old phrase, "I'll follow him anywhere." And Gregory did feel that. Yes, I would follow him in whatever he decides to do, and put all my strength, all my gifts at his disposal. But didn't all the others feel precisely the same thing? Hadn't all the arguments and uneasy conversations stopped? The whole house had assembled in the drawing-room, the hallway, on the stairs. Weren't all united? Didn't even Gregory's beloved Sevrain and the inscrutable and ever-diffident Notke the Wise stare at Lestat with the same complete submission? Even Lestat's mother, slouching against the front door in her dusty khaki, was eyeing her son with a certain iron satisfaction, as if to say, "Well, now, maybe something will indeed happen." Rose. Poor Rose, poor mortal Rose, poor tender, terrified Rose with her huge, searching blue eyes and her thick, blue-black, curling hair.
The sooner she was brought over, the better. A mortal mind could be damaged beyond repair by what this girl had witnessed. She was clinging to Lestat, like a shivering bride in her white silk dress, trying so desperately and selflessly to keep her weeping silent, and he, like a mighty bridegroom, held her in his arms, reassuring her once again as he gave her over to Louis. "Give me one precious moment, my dearest," he said to her, "and I will be with you. You are safe now." Gregory stared, astonished, as Lestat gestured for his mother to step aside and opened the front door. He went out onto the little portico and stared right at the young fledglings gathered three deep on the pavement, in the deep shadows of the giant trees that crowded the narrow street, whose electric lamps had been mysteriously disengaged several nights ago. A roar went up such as Gregory had never heard from assembled blood-drinkers in all his life. Not even the old armies of the Queen's blood had ever roared in such support for a leader. All this while, these young ones had defied Benji's warnings, gathering hour by hour to watch the house, and struggling to glimpse the faces that appeared at the windows, scrutinizing each passing car for new arrivals, though in fact arrivals seldom if ever came by car, and those that did managed to slide into the underground garage beneath the third townhouse of the assemblage. Not a single immortal within the house had dared to acknowledge the existence of these desperate creatures, not for an instant, except Benji, through the radio broadcast only, and always urging them gently not to gather, and to please go away. Yet they had come, and now they remained, irresistibly drawn to the only place around which they had hope. And this bold, bright, gentleman vampire, Lestat, went right down the steps now to the pavement to greet them. Reaching out, he drew them to himself in a huge, tight circle, telling them all in his commanding voice to be wise, to be careful, and above all, to be patient. All around Gregory, blood-drinkers within the house moved to the windows to watch this absolutely unprecedented spectacle. The peacock prince, with his dark, creamy skin and impeccable clothes, taking the time to talk to his subjects, and they were indeed his subjects, the rambling, scrambling baby vampires all trying to assure him of their love, their devotion, their innocence, their desire for a chance, their pledge to feed on the evil-doer only, to have no more quarrels, no fights, to do what he wanted, what he said, to have his love and his protection as a ruler. And all the while, the iPhones were flashing, even cameras were flashing, and the taller, stronger males were struggling to appear gentlemanly as they sought the front ranks, sought to grip his hand, the females throwing him kisses, and those in the back jumping up and down to wave to him. Beside Gregory, Benji Mahmoud was overcome with joy. "Do you see this?" he shouted, and jumped in the air now as if he was still the 12-year-old boy he'd been when the dark blood took him. "I am so sorry," Lestat said to the crowd in the most genuine and persuasive voice, "that I have taken so long to come to my senses, to know your needs, to know your desperation. Forgive me that I let you down in the past, that I ran from you, that I hid myself from those whose love I sought, and then disappointed. I'm here now, and I tell you we will survive this, do you hear me? And Benji Mahmoud is right. Out of the mouths of babes, he's right. Hell shall have no dominion." Again the roar went up from them, as if a tempest had hit the narrow street. What in the world did the mortals in those buildings across the way think of such things? What about the few cars that tried to make their way towards Lexington or Madison Avenue? What did it matter? This was Manhattan, where a crowd this size might loosely assemble outside a nightclub, or for a gallery opening, or for a wedding, and were they not quick to get out of the way of the mortal world if they had to? Oh, the daring of it all, to go right out there and speak to them, to trust that such a thing was possible. 60 centuries of superstition, secrecy, and elitism were being overturned in one precious moment. Lestat backed up the marble steps towards the portico, pausing with upraised hands, letting all those iPhones and cameras snap, even beaming at a mortal couple, young, curious, tourists in the big city, who passed, wondering what manner of celebrity was this, and then hurried on, slipping through the shifting blood-drinkers as if they were mere goth kids who would never harm anyone. "Now you must let us do our work," declared Lestat.
I ask you to listen to all that Benji has to say, especially on this night of all nights. And be patient with us. I'll come back to you myself in person when I have something important, truly important, to tell you."
A young female dashed forward and kissed his hand. The males were giving off raucous cries of support. Indeed, deep, guttural sounds were breaking out in the crowd, such as bloodthirsty mortal soldiers used to make, but which were now the stuff of sports audiences in packed arenas. Woot! Woot!
"Where shall we search for Victor?"
a male cried out from the middle of the empty street.
"Benji's told us to search, but where do we begin?"
Gregory could see that this shocked Lestat. He hadn't been prepared for this. Apparently he hadn't known that Benji had sent out the word as soon as Victor was kidnapped, but Lestat rose to the moment.
"He that brings Victor back safe to these front steps," he called out, "shall have his fill of my powerful blood in my grateful embrace, I swear to you."
Again the whole shifting and glittering assembly roared in unison.
"But be careful as you search, as you listen, as you use your gifts to cast a net for his voice, for images of him and where he's held captive. For this thing that has Victor is merciless, an outcast and a slayer of the greatest of his own kind, and therefore desperate. Come to us here, or call Benji with any intelligence. Now be safe, and be wise, and be good." "Be good!"
the crowd was screaming. With a great wave of his right hand, Lestat backed through the open door, and then he closed it. He stood there, as if catching his breath, his back to the dark panelled wood, and then he looked up, his large blue-violet eyes flashing over the surrounding faces like lights.
"Where has Louis taken Rose?"
he asked.
"Downstairs, the cellar," said Gregory. "We will see you in the attic."
The whole congregation moved upwards to the giant ballroom where the meeting would take place. By the time Gregory reached the top floor and walked into the vast, dimly lighted space, a conference table had been arranged by bringing lots of smaller, square tables, each covered in gold leaf, to form one great, glittering rectangle, with chairs up one side and down the other. This was directly beneath the central chandelier and illuminated by the chandeliers before and after it. All the residents and guests of the house were streaming into the room.
"Is there to be an order as to where we take our places?" asked Arjun, in a polite voice as he approached Gregory.
Gregory smiled.
"I don't think it matters as long as there's a vacant chair at that far end, at the head of the table."
Suddenly he realized that Sevrain was standing beside him, his ancient and precious blood wife, Sevrain. But there was no time for taking her in his arms, for telling her what a joy it had been earlier to see her come through the back garden and into this house with all her company. She couldn't possibly read his thoughts, but she knew what they were, nevertheless.
"We have the future now," she whispered. "Does it matter that we've wasted so many opportunities to meet in the past?"
And he said with a soft sigh,
"I honestly do believe that is true. We have the future."
But he was reassuring himself now, as well as he was reassuring her. 23. Lestat, in the multitude of counselors. There must have been 40 or 45 members of the undead in the ballroom when I entered it with Louis. I was carrying Rose. We had had the briefest of reunions in the quiet of a cellar room, but I had been unable to quiet her fears, or my own for that matter, as to leaving her, and so I'd vowed not to let her out of my sight.
"Be still, my darling," I whispered to her. "You're with us now, and everything is made new."
She snuggled against me, helpless and trusting, her heart beating dangerously fast against my chest. I stared at the assemblage. There were 16 or 17 blood drinkers flanking the broad table, made up as it was of 2 rows of small square tables, and most of these blood drinkers were speaking quietly to one another in little informal groups, Antoine with Cybele and Bianca with Alessandra, and some alone, such as Marius or Armand or my mother, merely watching and waiting without a word. Daniel was next to Marius. Eleni and Eugenie were beside Sevrain. On the far sides of the vast room were other small groups, though why they were out of the way like that I had no idea.
One or two were obviously ancient, and the others were far older than I was. The long, broad, rectangular table had no chairs at this end facing the door, and at the other end the lone chair was empty. Benji Mahmoud was standing by that chair. I sucked in my breath when I saw that empty chair. If they thought I was going to take that chair, they were crazy, or mad, to put it with more gravitas and grace. I wasn't going to do it. The two chairs nearest the head of the table were empty, too. Louis brought the bundle of silk pillows, and we walked down the length of the ballroom, as the others fell silent, unevenly. By the time Louis laid out the cushions to make a small, square bed with bolsters for Rose in the corner, no one was speaking. Her arms felt hot around my neck, and her heart was pounding. I put her down on the pillows and brought the blankets up over her. "Now you be quiet and don't try to follow what's happening. Just rest. Sleep. Be confident that Victor will be recovered. Be confident. You're in our care." She nodded. Her cheek burned against mine as I kissed her. I stepped back. She looked like a dewy pink mortal princess deposited there in the shadows, curled up now with the blankets covering her, bright eyes peering ahead of her at the great grouping around the table. Benji beckoned for me to come to the head of the table. He gestured to Louis that he'd take the chair opposite Benji's own. At Benji's side, Sibel stared at me with rapt fascination, and to her left, my tender fledgling musician Antoine could not have looked more worshipful. "No," I said. "I did walk up to the head of the table, yes, but I didn't take the chair." "Who places me at the head of this assembly?" I demanded. No one responded. I looked down the two rows of faces, so many I knew and so many I didn't know, and so many ancient and obviously supremely powerful, and none of the ghosts here, or the spirits. Why not? Why had the great Severin brought three ancient female blood drinkers, who were off to the side against the wall of French doors, just watching us, but not the spirits and the ghosts of the Talamasca? And why were they all looking at me, this august company? "Now listen to me," I said. "I don't have 300 years in the blood, as you say it now. Why am I standing here? Marius, what do you expect of me? Severin, why aren't you in this place? Or you?" I turned to one of the smoothest blood drinkers of the group. "Gregory." "Yes, all right, Gregory," I said. "Is there anyone who knows our world and their world out there better than you do, Gregory?" He looked to me to be as old as Maharet or Cayman, and his demeanor was so human as to have convinced anyone. Polish and capability and fathomless strength, that's what I saw in him, clothed as he was in some of the fanciest duds the modern world has to offer, with a handmade shirt and a gold watch on his wrist that was worth as much as diamonds. No one moved or spoke. Marius was regarding me with a faint smile. He wore a black suit, simple, with shirt and tie. Beside him, Daniel was similarly dressed, fully restored, this child who'd been so mad and lost after the last great debacle. And who were these others? Suddenly the names were coming at me telepathically, in a chorus of salutation. Davis, Avicus, Flavius, Arjun, Thorn, Notker, Everard. "Very well, stop, please," I said, putting up my hand. "Look, I went outside and spoke to the crowd because somebody had to do it, but I can't be the leader here." My mother, halfway down the table away from me on the left, started laughing. It was soft laughing, but it made me positively furious. David, who sat beside her as always, the British Oxford Don in his Harris Tweed Norfolk jacket, suddenly rose to his feet. "We want you to lead," he said. "It's that simple." "And you must lead," said Marius, who sat opposite him and had turned to me without rising, "because no one else feels he or she can effectively do it." "That's absurd," I said. But nobody heard it, because I was drowned out by a chorus of exhortations and encouragements.
"Lestat, we don't have time for this," said Severin.
Another very commanding female blood-drinker who sat beside Gregory, echoed the same words. She told me in a quick telepathic burst that her name was Chrysanthi. She stood now and said in a soft voice, "If anyone here had been willing to lead, well, it would have happened a long time ago. You've brought something entirely new to our history. I beg you now, follow through." Others were nodding and whispering in agreement. I had a multitude of objections. What had I ever done but write?